Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Noam Chomsky, a renowned professor of linguistics and philosophy at MIT. Chomsky has transcended the academy with an intellectual signature known around the globe for his critiques of American foreign policy and capitalism. An unrelenting critic of social injustice and state violence since his famed opposition to the Vietnam War, in one scholar's words, Chomsky's method involves a relentless erudition, scouring alternative sources, exhuming buried documents, reviving forgotten or abandoned histories. Noam Chomsky is coming to Memphis as the keynote speaker for the Mid-South Peace and Justice Center when it celebrates its remarkable 30th anniversary as the hub of grassroots activism and nonviolent engagement in Memphis on January 14th. On January 13th at 5 p.m. in the Bryan Campus Life Center, McCallum Ballroom on campus at Rhodes College, Chomsky will give a lecture on the Occupy movement, free and open to the public. I'm happy to have Noam Chomsky with me today on Counterpoint to discuss his life of activism. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Noam, I was very intrigued to learn a little about your upbringing, which is little known. You were born Avram Noam Chomsky to a father who fled the Tsarist Empire to become a noted Hebrew scholar in America. It seems you were quite influenced by the intensely Jewish intellectual milieu of New York, especially that of the European emigre intellectuals who congregated around a newspaper kiosk run by your uncle. Can you tell us a little about your upbringing and this milieu and how it shaped your outlook and political values?
Well, both of my parents, as you mentioned, were part of an emigre community, first-generation immigrants. The community was divided in many ways. One dividing line was kind of a struggle, a Kulturkampf, if you like, between the Yiddish-oriented and the Hebrew-oriented groups. There were others that just assimilated. The issue was which would be the language of Jewish survival, revival, culture in the United States and elsewhere. My parents were on the Hebrew side. They were both Hebrew teachers. My father, as you mentioned, was a Hebrew scholar who published work on the medieval Hebrew grammar, on the history of the Hebrew language, on Hebrew education, Jewish education, and other things. But the milieu was kind of, if you like, a cultural ghetto, not physical, but scattered through the city. There were people who had the same interests and concerns, all went to the same synagogue, knew each other, met each other. Actually, my future wife and I met when we were small children. Families knew each other. And it was very much permeated by the revival of Hebrew. The Hebrew language hadn't been spoken for a couple of thousand years. It was revived in the late 19th century, then connected with the Jewish settlement in Palestine. This is pre-state. For my father, he was what was called a Zionist, but a cultural Zionist, a follower of the Hebrew writer Ahad Ha'am, who wanted to see a cultural center for the Jewish people established in Palestine. That's one part of my young childhood, as you mentioned. By the time I was about 10 or 11 and was able to sort of go off on my own to New York, at that point about an hour train ride away, I became very much involved with groups there, partly around the newsstand that you mentioned. My uncle had a newsstand. I spent time there, worked there. There were lots of European emigres, recent European emigres. Also, I tended to gravitate down to the lower Manhattan, where there were bookstores, anarchist offices, bookstores run by emigres, recent emigres, some of them who fled the Spanish Civil War. And I spent a lot of time there, picked up literature, spent a lot of time talking to people. Milieu, at that time, my family was mostly working class, unemployed at the time, it's the 30s, though it picked up during the Second World War. There were jobs. But it was a lively working class culture, pretty rich culture, I should say, rich in high culture and also politically and so on. And I kind of was an atmosphere in which I felt comfortable and absorbed a lot from. Later, I went on to college and continued with some of the same interests, also other ones. Actually, I got involved in linguistics through connections with left, what at that time were Zionist, what would now be called anti-Zionist, anti-state currents of the Zionist movement, primarily through Zelig Harris, a very influential figure in the American intellectual community. But lots of young Jewish and other intellectuals passed through his influence. He was also the leading theoretical linguist in the country. I got involved, interested in his work, and it sort of went on from there.
Noam, let me fill in a little bit more of the biography then and pick up where you left off. Your master's thesis was titled The Morphophonemics of Modern Hebrew, and you completed your PhD in linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania in 1955, conducting part of your doctoral research during 4 years as a Harvard Junior Fellow. Within 6 years, you were already a full professor at MIT. 6 years later, in February 1967, you achieved fame as a leading activist against Vietnam with the publication in the New York Review of Books of your essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals. Your concluding lines read, "Only those who are willing to resist authority themselves when it conflicts too intolerably with their personal moral code, only they have the right to condemn the death camp paymaster. The question, what have I done, is one that we may well ask ourselves as we read each day of fresh atrocities in Vietnam, as we create or mouth or tolerate the deceptions that will be used to justify the next defense of freedom." Since I think your positions remained utterly consistent since this essay was written, can you amplify a little on how you understand the responsibility of intellectuals today?
It's, I think, pretty consistent back way before that. I wouldn't have called myself an intellectual when I was 10 years old, but that's when I wrote the first political article that I remember, 1939, right after the fall of Barcelona to Franco's troops. And it was about the spread of fascism through Europe and the threats and dangers that it posed as seen from the point of view of a 10-year-old. And it's continued without change since then. And I think it's the same today. What we call intellectuals are just people who have a certain level of privilege, access to resources, time, opportunities, which enable them to devote energy and effort to public affairs. So we don't call a scientist working in his laboratory, maybe doing brilliant work, and maybe he'll get the Nobel Prize. That's not what we call an intellectual. And we also don't call people like, say, my uncle, who ran the newsstand, an intellectual, though he was one of the most self-educated, never got past fourth grade, and well-read and thoughtful and inquiring people I've ever met, because he didn't have the opportunities to reach the public with his thinking and imagination and creativity and so on. So it's a small class of people, sometimes called public intellectuals, who have opportunities, and opportunity confers responsibility. Now then the question is, well, how do you meet those responsibilities? And if you look over history, the term intellectuals has only been used in the West in the modern sense for a little over a century. There are a category of people who are effectively what we call intellectuals. They critically analyze affairs of state. They're concerned with problems of justice and morality. They condemn crimes. They try to lead people, to induce people to pursue more constructive moral lives and so on. Those are what we're supposed to call intellectuals. It goes back to the earliest history. People who are called prophets in the Bible, translation of a confused, obscure Hebrew word, didn't mean prophet in the modern sense. They were basically what today we would call intellectuals. There were other people who we would call intellectuals. They were later called false prophets centuries later. They were the flatterers at the court. The pattern that was visible at that time has essentially perpetuated throughout history with very few changes. The prophets, who were later honored, many centuries later, at the time of their lives, were persecuted. You read that in the Bible. They were imprisoned, driven into the desert, and so on. They were denounced as haters of Israel because they condemned the evil king, and so on. The people later called false prophets, who were the majority of the intellectuals, if you like, they were very much honored at the time. And that goes right through history. So we recognize that very clearly in enemy states. So take, say, the old Soviet Union or today's Iran or China. There are people who we honor as dissidents. Of course, they're not honored in their own societies. They're punished. And the same is true quite generally. So just a couple of weeks ago, one of the leading East European intellectual heroes, dissidents, Václav Havel, died. And his death was commemorated in the United States, and many articles praising him for his courageous struggles against the Soviet system of repression, spent time in jail, and so on, all perfectly valid. That's the way dissidents were treated in Eastern Europe under the Soviet Union. How are they treated in our domains, say Central America? Well, much worse. Scholarship is well aware of this. The level of repression and violence against dissidents in Latin America under U.S. domination was far more extreme than in Soviet domains, certainly in the post-Stalin era, say, since 1960. And in fact, if you look at the leading intellectuals in our domains, so right at the time when Václav Havel was leading the liberation of Eastern European countries from Soviet control, right at the same time, six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests, had their brains blown out in El Salvador, a U.S. client state, by elite forces, which already had a bloody trail of victims behind them, thousands. They were U.S. armed and trained. They were just returning from additional training at Fort Bragg School of Counterinsurgency, the Kennedy School in North Carolina. They returned immediately to El Salvador. They acted under explicit commands of the explicit orders of the high command, which was in close contact with the U.S. Embassy. And they went into the university. They murdered the six Jesuit intellectuals, also their housekeeper and daughter, because the orders were to leave no victims. And this was about a couple of shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And in fact, it's kind of characteristic of the difference between U.S. domains and Soviet domains during that period. But we don't know anything about that. Now, there are very few people in the West, in the United States, let's say, who would know the names of the Jesuit priests leading Latin American intellectuals who were murdered by forces we were running at the same time that we were correctly, rightly cheering the liberation of Eastern Europe. That's, again, pretty characteristic. So what's the responsibility of intellectuals? Well, I think it's to follow the precepts and the actions of the Jesuit priests in our domains of Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia, and all the way back, including the period when the term intellectual first came into common use in the West. That was at the Dreyfus trial. The Dreyfusards, the defenders of Dreyfus, who we honor, were a small minority. The majority of intellectuals, so for example, the so-called immortals of the Académie Française, you know, the French Academy, they were strongly in support of the state, the criminal trial. They bitterly condemned the Dreyfusards. In fact, the leader of the Dreyfusard opposition, Emile Zola, a novelist, he had to flee France. But that's the model that should be followed. The honest dissidents committed to justice, principle, moral values, who usually face one or another form of punishment for it, as distinct from those who follow the model of the flatterers of at the court, the commissars in the old Soviet Union. And we can bring that up to practically any society that you think of.
The strain that you are following is that of the prophetic dissident intellectuals. And in a sense, if you follow the seeds that you leave in the course of the references that you make into the modern period, that goes through the philosophes and through the progressive intellectuals like Dewey and through anarcho-syndicalism or libertarian socialism. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Noam Chomsky about his life as an intellectual insurgent. Chomsky will be in Memphis to help celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Mid-South Peace and Justice Center on January 14th. In a free and open lecture on January 13th, he'll speak at Rhodes College at 5 p.m. about the Occupy movement, its background, and prospects. Noam, following from your critique of U.S. policy in Vietnam, in the 1970s you began to develop your critique of the U.S. news media, which achieved fruition in 1988 with arguably your most famous book, Manufacturing Consent: The Political Economy of the Mass Media. In it, you and co-author Edward Herman propose what you call a propaganda model of the media, which you write serves, quote, to propagandize on behalf of the powerful societal interests that control and finance it. So part of the reason we've never heard about these Jesuit intellectuals that you talked about is part and parcel of what you deal with in Manufacturing Consent. Now, this may sound a little loony to some listeners who buy into the idea of a free media in America and America as the leader of the free world. So can you explain what you address as the structural factors that shape the news in such a way that even the liberal media serves to support the interests of the privileged and powerful in America?
Actually, that book and most of my other work on the media and also the work of my colleague there, Edward Herman, has been directed to the liberal media. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about the right-wing media, which is kind of obvious. But much more interesting are the liberal media, I think. Also the liberal intellectuals, the kind who I wrote about in the article that you mentioned. The structure of intellectual life and of the media have a number of similarities. In the media, there are special factors. For example, take the United States. The major media, first of all, there's a very small range of independent media, what are called agenda-setting media, those that provide the framework that others more or less adhere to and that have the resources and so on to do that. New York Times, CBS News, now Fox News, a couple of others, very few of them. Benjamin Bagdicki, who for years is a leading scholar of the media, chair of the Berkeley School of Journalism, he wrote a series of books called The Media Monopoly, beginning, I think, in the early 80s and on for 20 years, and each successive edition reduced the number of independent media pretty sharply. So there's very few. They are major corporations. They're tied, often parts of even bigger corporations like General Electric and others. They have if you just look at them from a purely institutional point of view, they are businesses. And like other businesses, they have a product which they sell to market. The market, in the case of the corporate media, is advertisers. That is other businesses. CBS doesn't make any money when I turn it on, but it does make money from advertisers. And the same is true of the media generally. There's an advertising model and capital concentration model that entered the U.S. media scene about a century ago and has shaped it pretty much since. So there are businesses which sell a product, namely audiences, to other businesses. If you look at the elite media, especially the liberal media, the audience that they sell is pretty much what's called the political class. Sometimes, like maybe 20% of the population that's actively engaged in one or another form of management, ideological management, cultural management, political management in the government, economic management in the business system. These are groups that are pretty closely interlinked in many ways, some differences among them, but they share substantially commitments and concerns. So what you have is businesses selling elite audiences to other businesses. Well, if someone from Mars were looking at this and making a prediction, if rational, they would predict that the media content would reflect the interests of the sellers, the buyers, and the audience. There are many other factors that we discuss that tend in the same direction. Well, the bulk of the book, like 90% of it, is an empirical investigation of whether these predictions hold true. So we go after case, and we take case after case. We purposely pick the kind of cases that the media themselves select as their finest moments, and we attempt to demonstrate that the predictions of the model work quite remarkably well in these cases. I mean, a reader can judge whether we achieve that or not. The case of the dissidents in Eastern Europe and Central America that you just mentioned is one example. In fact, we discuss such cases, not this one, but others. And there are many others. Like, right at this minute, say, we usually commemorate anniversaries of major events. So, for example, we commemorate the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Everyone knows about that. Right now happens to be the 50th anniversary of a very major event, but it's not being commemorated. The event was John F. Kennedy's decision to shift U.S. policy in South Vietnam from support for a murderous, repressive client state, which had already killed tens of thousands of people, to shift from that to a direct invasion of South Vietnam. Starting from November 1961, Kennedy issued a series of orders which sent the U.S. Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, authorized napalm, authorized chemical warfare to destroy ground cover and crops, initiated programs that drove ultimately millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps and urban slums. Well, if another country did that, we'd call it aggression. It aroused almost no concern or interest at the time, and it's forgotten today. And I won't go on to say what happened next. What happened, everyone should know, is horrifying atrocities, first mainly in South Vietnam, then extending to the north and to Laos, finally to Cambodia, when in the early 70s, the United States launched an incredible bombing campaign. In the early 70s, Cambodia was rural Cambodia. You know, poor peasant society of rural Cambodia was attacked at the level of all Allied bombing in the Pacific area during all of World War II, including two atom bombs. That's pretty intense bombing, all directed against the rural society of Cambodia. It was all following orders of Henry Kissinger, transmitted by Henry Kissinger from the president, in Kissinger's words, anything that flies on anything that moves. That's a call for genocide of a kind that you rarely find in the archival record. It's all there. Does anybody know about it? Almost no one.
And your point is obviously that these things get marginalized because of the structural forces that condition the media, and therefore that ultimately the notion that there is a left-wing bias in the media is really absurd if one, in fact, examines the political economy, the structures and institutions in which the media operates.
More if you look at the content. Actually, incidentally, I think that I have some sympathy for the idea that there's a what's called a liberal bias in the media. That is, within the very narrow right-wing spectrum of American sort of received doctrine, the media tend to be sort of toward the critical side of that spectrum. So take, say, the war in Iraq, which happened to have been criticized across the spectrum, but Barack Obama, for example, was considered on the liberal side. So he criticized the war in Iraq. He described it as a strategic blunder. Well, we call that criticism of American actions. We don't call the same stand criticism of, say, Russian actions. So when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, you could find people writing in the Communist Party press who said this is a strategic blunder. It's going to cost too much. We're not going to gain our ends. We don't call that criticism. We call it utterly unprincipled. But when it's done with regard to actions of ours, then it's considered courageous and principled. Well, in that sense, you can say that there's a liberal bias. So take, say, the war in Vietnam again. At the end of the war, 1975, there were, of course, lots of articles about it. Perhaps the most critical opinion, which would be called, you know, far to the left in the American spectrum, was by Anthony Lewis in the New York Times. What he wrote is that the war began with what he called blundering efforts to do good. Now, that's describing the Kennedy decisions I mentioned. But then it turned out by 1969 that it was a disaster, too costly to ourselves. We couldn't impose democracy at a cost that we could tolerate. Well, that's called liberal criticism. I should mention at about the same time, polls showed that about 70% of the American population described the war as not a mistake, but fundamentally wrong and immoral. Try to find that somewhere, and not just in the media, but in the writings of articulate intellectuals, except at the very fringe.
So again, to rephrase, it's really the very, very limited contours in which so much of the public discussion happens as a result of the structural forces that condition the mainstream media. Now, by the 1990s, all the strands of your political work were in place. Anti-imperialism, critical media analysis exploring the role of corporate interests in manufacturing consent, all the way to your writings on democracy and the labor movement in an era of neoliberalism. These ideas have certainly been at the base of the Occupy movement. Indeed, the title of your book, Profit Over People, Neoliberalism and the Global Order, could serve as a bumper sticker for the issues raised by the Occupy movement. Can you say a little about how you think the Occupy movement has been represented in the media and what you think of its prospects as a genuinely transformative movement?
Well, at first, the Occupy movement was greeted with some derision, but as its scale and extent became clear, it did start to get a degree of support, and interestingly, from the very beginning, it got pretty strong support from parts of the business press. So the world's major business journal, the London Financial Times, right at the beginning had editorial op-ed comments praising the movement. And they picked out aspects of it which are very, very significant. It may not be the main ones that the Occupy movement is driving for, but they're significant and they should bother everyone. The Occupy movement, and this is so far its great success, is it did bring into the center of public discourse issues that had been there and that the population knew about, but that had been very much marginalized. For one thing, the extraordinary inequality of American society that's developed in the last 30 years. There has been economic growth over this period, not as much as in earlier years, but some. But it's gone into very few pockets. In fact, overwhelmingly gone to the hands of a tiny sector of the society, about 0.1%. That's what weighs very heavily in the economic distribution. Whereas for the majority of the population, about real wages have pretty much stagnated, sometimes declined. People have been getting by means that cannot be continued. First of all, by much higher workload, much higher than Europe by now, by debt, which can't go on forever, and by relying on bubbles, asset inflation, like the recent real estate bubble. Well, those are going to burst, and when they do, this paper wealth disappears. And you have the sector that has gained most overwhelmingly is the financial sector, which grew substantially in the last 30, 35 years. It's very doubtful that it contributes anything much to the economy. In fact, it may harm it. But it's grown very powerful and significant and extremely influential in the electoral process and everywhere else. These things have been happening, and people know it in their lives. But there hadn't been any organized voice of opposition to it or even clarification of what was going on. And you could read about it in books, you know, but people, of course, knew what was happening to them. But it was atomized, disorganized, inarticulate. And the Occupy movements brought all this together and indeed much more. And some of this was recognized by media commentary, sometimes positively, in fact, while putting aside the much broader goals of a good deal of the movement. One of the major achievements of the Occupy movement, I think, has been simply to bring people together to work with mutual support for a common purpose. So the communities that were formed, spontaneously formed, are communities of mutual support, of creating bonds and associations, whether it's a built common kitchen that serves everyone needs, a library, whatever it may be. They bring people together in general assemblies where they seriously discuss issues, work things out among each other. These are very important developments in a society like ours, which is highly atomized, in which people are pretty isolated and alone and have very few of the kinds of associations in which you can interact with other people in such ways as even to find out who you are, to form your own ideas, to hear a critical analysis of them, to discuss them. Just creating these bonds and associations in itself is a highly significant achievement, which I think will be lasting, along with the shifting of the focus of national dialogue to critical issues that were much too much marginal and are now harder to ignore. And some of that has been recognized in media commentary. Of course, much of it is just denigrated. The repression, anticipated repression, did come along. It looks as if it was coordinated nationally, driving the movements out of the squares they had occupied, sometimes pretty brutally. And now new developments are taking place and will continue to. So, for example, on, I think it's January 16th, our plans for a major demonstration in Washington bringing together the old civil rights movement, including participants in it and those who've been part of it in its various forms since then, bringing them together with the Occupy movements in Washington could be an important development, and there are others.
Now, Noam, since the economic meltdown, and in a context where, as you've already alluded, there's a greater divide between rich and poor in America today than at any other period besides the late 19th century, which historians refer to as the age of robber barons, there have been two movements that have arisen railing against elites, the Tea Party and the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement seeks to reclaim power for the 99% from corporate interests, while the Tea Party has primarily focused its anger on the government. Why do you think the focus of the Tea Party is misguided and misplaced?
The Tea Party movement is largely a reflection of the corporate elite. It's very heavily funded by the corporate sector, by segments of right-wing sectors of the corporate sector. The movement itself is quite small, and it's drawn from relatively affluent, almost entirely white sectors of the population. Now, this is not to denigrate it, just to say who it is. There isn't much in the way of Tea Party activism. There's meetings now and then, that sort of thing. But they've become very influential, but that's because they're pursuing policies which are highly supported by exactly those sectors that have gained enormously from the policies of the past generation. Not exactly those sectors, but close to them. So these are very different kinds of manifestations.
Professor Chomsky, there's so much more I would have wanted to discuss with you today. Thanks for being with us on Counterpoint.
Glad to talk to you.
This conversation will be continued live in Memphis with Chomsky's lecture on the Occupy movement, Friday the 13th at 5 p.m. at Rhodes College, Bryan Campus Life Center, McCallum Ballroom, where it begins a new lecture series called Communities in Conversation that will roll out all spring term. To keep posted about these free and open events, visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/communities.in.conversation. Chomsky also headlines the 30th anniversary celebration of the Mid-South Peace and Justice Center on January 14th. For tickets or to learn more about their nonviolent grassroots activism, visit their website at midsouthpeace.org. And to hear other podcast interviews with leading academics and intellectuals helping to reorient the public debate, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the Counterpoint link underneath the news menu, where you can also post your comments about this interview. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.